RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Harvey Week is a 30-year veteran of the petrochemical industry, passionate about New Zealand's economic success and the role in the energy sector. One of his biggest achievements was his successful efforts to maintain a viable methanol operation at Methanex in Taranaki after the 2003 Maui gas redetermination slashed the company's feedstock supplies. I think it's fair to say that Harvey is our go-to on energy matters, and boy, have we got some energy issues right now. So I want to welcome Harvey Week back to RCR. Hi, Harvey. Thanks for coming back on.
You're welcome there, Paul.
Okay, yesterday in our news, I heard that Fonterra was saying that their energy prices had doubled, and obviously, being Fonterra, my ears instantly pricked up, and they were basically saying that the spike in energy prices could threaten our international competitiveness. Obviously, they'd feel that. What do you make of that?
Well, entirely predictable, Paul. I mean, this has been a slow-motion wreck for probably at least 5 to 10 years. So, you know, with electricity supply, you have low cost, reliable, and green. You can have two out of three, you can't have all three.
Mm.
And what we've done is we've had a predominant focus on reducing CO2. So we've got 100% renewables target set by the last government, and we had a ban on oil and gas. So this is a predictable outcome. And the net effect of having 100% target on renewable and adding more wind and solar capacity only serves to reduce the reliability of our system. And ultimately, we need more thermal to back it up when it's not windy.
I know people like you have been saying this for, well, you mentioned the time span there. And obviously no one's listened. But as you say, so predictable, which is almost unforgivable, isn't it?
Well, I think the people that are making these decisions, you know, they don't really have, I don't think they've got the necessary capabilities to understand, or at least the skills to see a very, very big picture here. And ultimately, you know, having 100% renewables target for electricity makes no sense. And the electricity industry has been, you know, on at the government for years on that target. It's a dumb target. You're better to have something like, you know, 85-90, which is kind of pretty damn good. But as you add more intermittent supply, you ultimately have to add more thermal capacity. And so when you do have a dry year, or you have a couple of months where there's no wind, you've got to have your backup. And the only backup options are either gas or coal. And given that gas is in short supply, switching to coal is the only other option left.
So that's what's going to happen, Harvey.
What's going to happen.
Yeah. And we've got the coal, haven't we?
Well, we're going to be importing, because we don't want to use Southland lignite. So
why not?
Because it's too hard to get resource consents and what have you.
Yeah, but you can change the law. It's a national emergency.
Yes, you can do that. But I would suggest that the most economic proposition, well, first of all, I think in the short term, to deal with the here and now, is for the government, encourage the government to negotiate with the big industrial gas users like Methanex to see if we can actually divert increasing amounts of gas away from producing methanol into producing peak electricity, if the peakers are short of gas today. So that's kind of step one. Step two is probably immediately is to pull back on immigration targets and only bring in the necessary skills of immigrants that need to come in on the basis of a pre-existing job offer, if you like. Yeah. For an essential worker only, but we need to cut the rate of population growth, because population growth ultimately means demand growth, and we don't have the supply to support the demand growth. So we're going to need to have a cut in immigration probably for 10 years while we build out additional supply capacity. So that's short term.
Yeah.
Longer term, we need to obviously encourage the LNG feasibility study, which I understand is underway, but I suspect it's going to be 8 years away before you have that available to us. And I think it's going to cost well in excess of $1 billion. So who's going to pay? We've got a, you know, as the big industrial gas users disappear, the domestic gas consumption is very small. And so you've got a huge amount of capital spread across very, very small demand. So I'm a bit skeptical as to whether the economics will actually sustain it. So I don't think we now have enough growth, enough demand. And then in the interim, import diesel into Armata and in Taranaki. The tank's already there. And then pipe that diesel into the existing Taranaki peaking plants if they run out of gas. So we can at least run them on diesel in the interim for, you know, maybe the next sort of decade or so.
Okay.
Until such time as we figure out what the replacement is. And then on the market side, we've got, I think we need two big tweaks to the market. At the moment, the clearing, you know, every 15 minutes, the supply and the demand gets cleared on the margin every 15 minutes, as I understand, and the price of that marginal capacity sets the entire load of supply for that period. So what we have in Singapore is we have a two-tier system. We have a base, and then we bid on the margin, on the incremental. Mm. And what you do is you end up with a lower cost base because the hydroelectric's been around for 50 years. We don't need to be paying $800 for hydro. It only costs about $10 a megawatt an hour to run. So we should be experiencing, consumers should be experiencing the benefit of a low-cost base and the cost of the marginal supply. And that's the Singapore model. And then the second element that I would tweak on the market is having an insurance provision for backup supply that's paid as a levy across the entire industry, which basically provides a revenue stream for Genesis to run the Huntly power plant when it's needed. And if it's not needed, we're still paying for the operational capability to run when it is needed. And that, to me, is an insurance or a resilience that's available to the country. And on top of that, we need to encourage Genesis to explore the capital cost of installing a fourth unit in that Huntly power plant. The fourth unit's been decommissioned a few years back. It's 250 megawatts. There's four of them there for 1,000, right? So the one that's been decommissioned, to replace that with a brand new supercritical steam coal unit, anywhere between 250 and 500 megawatts. And okay, put that into the existing power station, so that we end up with Huntly having an ability to run up to 1,000 megawatts or even a bit more, given that our population is now 5 million. When it was consented, it was more like 3 million. So we do need that backup.
I was just thinking, the way you were describing the pricing every 15 minutes in the hydro, given that, yeah, it was built ages ago and it was primarily funded by taxpayers.
Yes.
Does that speak to then what people are saying about profiteering and the way the market works?
The way the market works is that it clears on the margin. So if you've got very, very expensive margin, everyone reaps the benefit of that. The shareholders of the power companies reap the benefit of that exorbitant price on a cost structure that's extremely low. And at the end of the day, power is a utility, an essential utility for New Zealanders. It's not for the shareholders of the power companies to make a killing. So So to me, it just represents a market market failure, similar to what happened to California. And I think we need to adopt the Singapore model, where a good chunk of the benefit of low-cost power accrues back to the consumers.
Yeah. Well, you'd hope, wouldn't you?
Exactly. So it would mean that, obviously, the shareholders would have less dividends and all that jazz, but at the end of the day, they'd still make a good return. I'm not saying that they shouldn't be making a good return, but they should be making a utility return, not a standard company that's competing in the marketplace for its products and has to sell its products on a competitive market. This is really a utility company, so they should not be getting returns anything greater than a utility return.
Yeah, I understand. Were the good old days better? Can't help but ask that. You know, when we owned it all, you know, the taxpayer, and
well,
it was that utility.
I don't know. I do like the market. I think the market's fine, but I think it's inefficient. One thing about having an old ECNZ is you only had one procurement department, one HR, one IT, you know. So yep. All your back office systems was only one for the country. Now you've got that replicated six or seven times for each company. So,
yep.
And the idea of having all these, you know, market, you know, focusing on trying to compete for the residential market, that's not really where the competition should be. The competition should be in the supply of the generation. And we yep. don't really have proper forces unless you change the clearinghouse structure.
We had Ag Simon Court on, his spokesperson for Energy Matters, among other things, for ACT last week, and he was talking about his proposal for a cross-party accord, sort of bedding in energy like, you know, superannuation, where everyone agrees and there's no swinging of the pendulum and flip-flopping from administration to administration. I think we've talked about that before. You'd support that,
well,
right?
Essentially, New Zealand actually had that for probably 70 or 80 years. It's only in the last, really since Jacinda Ardern sort of banned the oil and gas and had a 100% renewables target that came out of left field. If we hadn't had those two interventions, we would have been, you know, I think the difference between Labor and National is not a lot. And I think Labor's got a lot of soul searching to do because they've screwed us up. And those two changes in policy were ill thought through. And somehow, you know, Labor's going to have to eat some humble pie and backtrack and come to the table and say, okay, we got that one wrong. But let's take it off the political agenda and just focus, let the market, you know, work. Make sure that the market's set up properly. And I think there's some tweaks I've suggested that we need to do so that we've got some proper drivers that deliver value to the consumers. But at the end of the day, New Zealand benefits from low-cost power. Make no mistake about it. Having high-cost power with the shareholders of the power companies making a killing is not good for the country. Because you don't, you know, at the end of the day, we gain far greater productivity from lower cost power and leveraging that low cost power into products that we actually produce.
And that all feeds through to standard of living at a very fundamental level.
Flows into everything. And so, and ultimately with Huntly running, you know, if they invested in the fourth coal unit, in the future, you can switch all of that coal capacity to using forestry biomass as the bio coal as a domestic supply. So I think that's how you do that. But you can't do all that in one hit. You know, you first of all convert the, you know, make sure that the station's actually good to go for 1,000 megawatts. And then you import the coal for the, you know, until such time as the forestry waste has been that model has been developed and scaled up, and once that's scaled up, we can eliminate the importation of coal and use forestry waste, and you know that would be brilliant for the country. So we could do all of that, but it takes some time.
Simeon Brown, who's the minister, he says he's engaging with sector stakeholders and requested the Electricity Authority and Commerce Commission to investigate potential profiteering. How much time is there fluffing around before, you know, go back to Fonterra, what they said? There's urgency here, isn't there? You can talk.
There is.
Have talk fests. How long does it take?
Well, I think one of the things I'm a little bit dubious about is the institutional capability in Wellington. Whether it's Commerce Commission, whether it's the MB, or whether it's, you know, the various departments, from an outsider looking in, it feels to me that they've lost a lot of capability. And so, you know, you've got this idea of groupthink down there where, you know, let's focus on CO2's the enemy. You know, we've got to meet the Paris Accord at any cost. And I think that's stupid. You know, I would be advocating to actually at some point in the future to basically cancel or eliminate the Paris Accord agreement that New Zealand's committed to, and put a cap on the ETS CO2 at you know, a nominal amount like $40 or $50, until such time as that we've actually developed a secure, low cost, and reliable system.
Yeah,
and if you don't do it in that order, you're going to end up with blackouts.
Oh gosh,
you know, this is quite basic stuff, but you can't have a Paris Accord and let's reduce CO2. That's not going to work. You've got to develop the infrastructure to enable us to migrate away from it over time, and you can't just introduce policy and hope that that's going to be the answer. That's not going to work.
Walking away from that Paris Agreement would be a huge U-turn in perceptual terms.
Not really. I don't think it's going to survive even 2030. I think many countries around the world are facing the same crippling problems. And I think people increasingly are just going to start walking away from it. What's going to happen is that they're just not going to meet their commitments anyway. And there's a reason why they won't meet the commitments, is that the fundamentals don't make sense. You know, at the end of the day, you know, even if you electrified everything in transport in the world, you know, all your cars, you'd only reduce the CO2 by 9%. And you've spent trillions and trillions on doing that.
Yeah.
You know, CO2 is embedded in everything that we consume, from the clothes you wear to the houses you build to the appliances, you know, everything. So, so I think I'm not advocating to cut the Paris commitments today, but I'd be very, very cautious about, you know, we've got to pick the right time to basically back out of that agreement and stop New Zealand dollars going offshore to pay for carbon credits and what have you. I would be turning that tap off and then putting those funds into infrastructure in the country that would actually have a real benefit of reducing the CO2 longer term in a positional manner.
Common sense overload, Harvey. Go
yeah,
easy.
Yeah, you know, you can't do it one hit.
What about the case to assist businesses, do you think, who are struggling in the short term with high energy prices? Is there a case?
Oh, that's a tough one, Paul. That's a very tough one, because fundamentally what you're really talking about is rolling blackouts in the country today. It's just that the consumers are not feeling it. It's the industrial sector that's feeling it. So they've lost, you know, basically we're saying, you know, the price is saying you can't afford to run. Okay, you can't afford to run, so there's not enough supply. So they're being cut. Now, if you spread it evenly across the country, you'd end up with, you know, a few hours a day of no power for blocks of the population all up and down the country. So what's happening is that the industrial users are taking the full hit of this. Should they be compensated?
Well, you know, jobs could go big time.
But the jobs, you know, we have to fix the supply. Like I've suggested these things. We're in this pickle that's been a train wreck in the making for 8 to 10 years. You're not going to turn that train around overnight. I just don't see, if they can't survive in the short term, they won't survive. And I just, you know, paying them to keep going, I don't know. I'm not on that page.
Yeah, but are you saying that we're so short of energy potentially that they're going to have blackouts anyway? Maybe
exactly. It's either the domestic consumers are going to have cold homes, or the industrials can keep running. I mean, or a combination of the two. But we're in a precarious position now. Obviously, as soon as it starts raining at some point in the future, and the hydro lakes fill up, you know, we'll be a bit better. But don't forget, the hydro lakes are only 6 weeks of storage.
Yeah.
So
okay.
This
is that
issue
all right.
You know, can come around very quickly at any time of the year, which it's happened in the past. But don't forget, the hydro was installed in the 50s and 60s and 70s, predominantly when the population was only 2.5-3 million people.
Yeah,
now we've got
point.
5 million people consuming that much more power. So, yeah, you're going through the water a lot faster.
We didn't think that one through.
And the more wind and the more solar we add, the faster, you know, the more unreliable the grid becomes. So the answer is thermal or geothermal, not wind and solar.
It seems we didn't think much through very well at all, because that level of immigration obviously hasn't been thought through either, because look at the consequences, the extra
load. Who's doing the thinking?
That's what
I'm saying. The institutions in Wellington, you know, they're charged with doing the stuff. That's why I'm saying, you know, I'm not impressed with the capability that's obviously showing down there. So if they don't have the capability, no point in having them there, quite frankly.
No,
they're not doing much. I'm pretty disappointed with the capability and thinking. And I think, you know, to me, it feels like a case of groupthink. Everyone's focusing on, oh, wind is the answer, solar's the answer, get rid of thermal, we don't need coal, we don't need gas, we don't need this, we don't. Really? Who are you kidding?
Well, not you and many of our listeners. They're not kidding them either. Do you think it's going to rain in time, Harvey?
Well, yeah, it'll rain in time. Who knows? That's how long is a bit of string. But I think the industrial users are going to do it hard for a while. And they'll probably need to think more carefully about maybe contingency planning, you know, tougher measures in the future, maybe some energy storage for themselves. Maybe they should be committing to some of this biocoal. You know, there's some opportunities around what forestry could be investing quite heavily in biocoal.
Yeah, yeah.
And having their own power supply.
All that slash stuff.
Millions of tons of it, right? Absolutely. There's enough forestry residue to run 1,000 megawatts of thermal in New Zealand. So we've got plenty of it around. It's just that we don't seem to have the will to spend the capital. And the capital that we need to spend is small compared with all of these other big things we've just talked about. You're talking about tens of millions, not billions.
Well, we used to spend it in the past, didn't we?
We used to spend it in a directed way, and sometimes we probably overspend. I'm thinking of the Ministry of Works and Development. Man, they could build stuff, but it was probably twice as heavy as it needed to be, but still lasted for 100 years. But we've lost that capability today.
That's why I was reminiscing about the old days, you see.
Well, there's a place, but I think the scale of what we need to do with infrastructure is not of the 1950s scale. What we need to do is just be smart about incremental capacity and balancing a little bit of extra intermittent with geothermal and thermal. Geothermal, there is some geothermal coming on at the end of the year.
Uh-huh.
So that's all good stuff. But I think we still need a mixture of thermal and geothermal.
Harvey, good to catch up with you again. Sounds like a good plan. Hopefully the right people are listening. All right?
Yeah, you take care, Paul, and thanks for having me on.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.